Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations coast to coast and border to border here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on arguments, legal arguments that have been destroyed. Destroyed arguments. Stand by. Well, when people call the law school and they ask, how can I learn more about the topics that you speak on over the air, I want you to keep in mind that most of these topics that you hear on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my classes here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law and Alfred the Great and so on, it was Alfred the Great that codified the common law back in 872 A.D. He created 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 are incorporated into our federal constitution and our Bill of Rights. Now, the common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai by God himself. It's recorded in the Bible in Exodus 19, verse 16 through Exodus 24, verse 8, and it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income tax, property tax, and social security taxes. These IRS tax laws are in reality a counterfeit of the tithing laws of Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and social security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. We owe this income tax and social security tax because we've contracted into it. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website and send me an email. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and just send an email request. Be sure to put your mailing address so they'll have a place to send the CD package. Now, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the 14th Amendment, I broached the subject. We talked about McKinney versus Reagan and Lonsdale versus United States. Here's a third case, United States versus Kruger. Now, the Kruger's principal argument below and on appeal is that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution unlawfully purported to bestow citizenship upon non-white races and other artificial statutory persons. This argument is absurd. And perhaps the most famous advocate of this argument was John Cheek, whose criminal conviction went to the U.S. Supreme Court. See Cheek versus United States, cited at 498 U.S. 192. Cheek sent me copies of his motions and briefs that he had filed pro se in his case, one of which was just a single-page motion, which in essence stated that he could not be prosecuted because he was not a 14th Amendment citizen. Naturally, such non-substantive motions are denied, and Cheek's motion was, in fact, denied. Cheek's appeal would have involved this argument if he had reached the conclusion that it had merit. However, the only issue which was decided in the appeal to the Supreme Court regarded the validity of the willfulness jury instruction given at trial. Now, there's a thing here called implementing regulations. In United States versus Hartman, 915 Fed Supplement 1227, it's in the Middle District of Florida, decided in 1996, the argument regarding implementing regulations and cross-references in the CFR index were held to be frivolous. Now, taxes are contractual. In McLaughlin versus the CIR, I believe that's Internal Revenue, I don't know what the C is, in 832 Fed 2nd, 986, the Seventh Circuit in 1987 held this argument to be without merit. The notion that the federal income tax is contractual or otherwise consensual in nature is not only without foundation, but has been repeatedly rejected by the courts. Now, Bernard Sussman has a collection of cases involving parties who raised this contract argument, and you may study those cases by clicking here. Now, number 18, the simple facts regarding the We Are Subjects of the British Crown issue. Several years ago, some people developed an argument that we are still subjects of the British Crown and started to promote that. You are free to believe that argument, which will waste your time, but here's a simple refutation of the argument. The Articles of Confederation provide as follows. Article 2. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. And number 2. Our country and the British Crown signed the Treaty of Peace on September the 3rd, 1783, and the first provision of which reads as follows. Quote, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States, New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia to be free, sovereign, and independent states, that he treats with them as such, and for himself, his heirs and successors, relinquishes all claims to the government, proprietary, and territorial rights of the same and every part thereof. Unquote. Question. Does the 1783 peace treaty still exist? Well, all one needs to do to confirm this is to check out a government publication entitled Treaties in Force, which can be found in any good library, especially a university library. And under the list of our treaties with Great Britain and the United Kingdom, you will find that this 1783 treaty is still in effect, at least a part of it. Only Article 1 is in force. The War of 1812 resulted in modifications of this treaty, and so did later treaties. Now, a treaty is a contract between sovereign powers. Now, the courts have not been silent regarding the effect of the Declaration of Independence and the Treaty of Peace. For example, the consequences of independence was explained in Harcourt versus Gallard at 25 U.S., that's also cited at 12 Wheat 523, back in 1827, where the Supreme Court said this, quote, There was no territory within the United States that was claimed in any other right than that of someone of the Confederated States. Therefore, there could be no acquisition of territory made by the United States distinct from or independent of someone of those states. Each declared itself sovereign and independent according to the limits of its territory. The soil and sovereignty within their acknowledged limits were as much theirs at the Declaration of Independence as at this hour. Unquote. In McIlvaney versus Cox's Leesee, cited 8 U.S. or 4 Cranch 209, in 1808, the Supreme Court said this. This opinion is predicated upon a principle which is believed to be undeniable, that the several states which composed this union, so far at least as regarded their municipal regulations, became entitled, from the time when they declared themselves independent, to all of the rights and powers of sovereign states, and that they did not derive them from concessions made by the British king. The Treaty of Peace contains a recognition of their independence, not a grant of it. From hence, it results that the laws of the several state governments were the laws of sovereign states, and as such, were obligatory upon the people of such state from the time that they were enacted. Now, in reference to the Treaty of Peace, the same court said this. It contains an acknowledgement of the independence and the sovereignty of the United States in their political capacities and a relinquishment on the part of His Britannic Majesty of all claim to the government, proprietary, and territorial rights of the same. These concessions amounted, no doubt, to a formal renunciation of all claim to the allegiance of the citizens of the United States. And then finally, in Ingalls versus Trustees of the Sailors Smug Harbor, cited at 28 U.S., that's 3 Peter 99, decided in 1830, the question squarely arose as to whether Americans are subjects of the crown, a proposition that is flatly rejected by that court. They said, quote, It is universally admitted both in English courts and in those of our own country that all persons born within the colonies of North America, while subject to the crown of Great Britain, were natural-born British subjects. And it must necessarily follow that that character was changed by the separation of the colonies from the parent state and the acknowledgement of their independence. The rule as to the point of time at which the American Antenati ceased to be British subjects differs in this country and in England, as established by the courts of justice in the respective countries. The English rule is to take the date of the Treaty of Peace in 1783, and our rule is to take the date of the Declaration of Independence. In support of the rule set forth in this case, the court cited an English case to demonstrate that the English courts had already decided that Americans were not subjects of the crown. They said, quote, The doctrine of perpetual allegiance is not applied by the British courts to the American Antenati. This is fully shown by the late case of Doe versus Acklam in Two Barns and Crenshaw 779. Chief Justice Abbott says that James Ludlow, the father of Francis May, the lessor of the plaintiff, was undoubtedly born a subject of Great Britain, and he was born in a part of America which was at that time, the time of his birth, a British colony and parcel of the dominions of the Crown of Great Britain. but upon the facts found were of the opinion that he was not a subject of the Crown of Great Britain at the time of his birth and of his daughter. She was born after the independence of the colonies was recognized by the Crown of Great Britain, after the colonies had become United States, and their inhabitants generally citizens of those states. And her father, by his continued residence in those states, manifestly became a citizen of those states, and he considered the Treaty of Peace as a release from their allegiance of all British subjects who remained there. A declaration, says he, that a state shall be free, sovereign, and independent is a declaration that the people composing the state shall no longer be considered as subjects of the sovereign by whom such a declaration is made, unquote. Now let's take a note here. The note, the linked copies of these cases highlight the important parts of these opinions for your convenience, and notwithstanding the fact that English and American courts long ago rejected this argument, I still encounter emails from parties who contend that this argument is correct. For example, just recently, I ran across this note, which stated, in other words, the interstate system of banks is the private property of the king. This means that any profit or gain anyone experienced by a bank, thrift, and a loan, employee credit union, any regulated financial institution carries with it as an operation of law the identical same full force and effect as if the king himself created the gain. So as an operation of law, anyone who has a depository relationship or a credit relationship with a bank, such as checking, savings, CDs, charge cards, car loans, real estate mortgages, are experiencing profit and gain created by the king. So says the Supreme Court. At the present time, Mr. Kondo, you have bank accounts because you accept checks as payment for books and subscriptions, and you're very much in an equity relationship with the king, unquote. Now, this note also alleged that George Mercier, who wrote an article apparently popular among those who believe the contract theory of government, was a retired judge, which is false. Not just because you read it on the net doesn't make it true. So one of the advocates of this flaky idea is a guy named David Gould, spelled G-O-U-L-D, David Gould, who has a webpage named The Amazing Vision of David Gould, where he promotes this trash. This last summer, Gould joined a couple of email lists, which I received and started blasting this theory in a series of email notes. According to Gould, one of the reasons that we are Brits is because the King of England, by way of a treaty in 1782, loaned the United States funds to encourage or to engage in the war against him. Gould maintains that the fact that the king was loaning money to us to fight him really shows that even today we're still subjects of the crown. In reply, I pointed out that the treaty that he mentions was really a French treaty, where the United States borrowed money for the revolution from the King of France, not the King of Great Britain, and I sent out a series of email notes which refuted everything that Gould declared, and it did not take long before Gould stopped this nonsense. However, my belief that I had corrected Gould and educated him about an incorrect legal argument proved erroneous. I have examined his webpage recently, and he has only become more virulent in his argument that we are citizens of Great Britain. And clearly, Gould is not only crazy and a fit candidate for the Nut House, but he's also deliberately lying to the very people that he is writing to and contending that he's educating. He is a liar year. Now, what makes him particularly dangerous is the fact that he blends religion with his argument. I absolutely and totally dislike people who combine Christianity with false legal arguments, and I dislike people who hold my religion up to disrepute by associating it with these kinds of nutty ideas. Number 19, the United States is foreign to the states. And this is another one of these arguments that have been refuted by the courts. Now remember, we're talking about Larry B. Craft's webpage. Larry B. Craft has taken a number of articles that have been refuted by the courts, and he's simply telling us that if you follow these arguments that have already been decided and decided against you, and you take them up, they will be decided against you in your case. They don't have legal merit. So number 19, the United States is foreign to the states. That is, the federal government of the United States is a foreign entity, and that we're really citizens of the state in which we live. This is the state citizenship argument that Bob Wengrud used to argue so vehemently for. A popular belief promoted in the freedom movement is the concept or idea that the United States is a foreign sovereign as regards the states. How this idea got started is beyond me. Well, it was Bob Wengrud, because the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts have concluded otherwise. You'll see this in Clapham versus Houseman, that's C-L-A-F-L-I-N versus Houseman, H-O-U-S-E-M-A-N, cited at 93 U.S. 130. The United States is not a foreign sovereignty as regards the several states. It's also reported in Severson versus Homeowners Loan Corporation, 88 Pacific 2nd, 344. You'll find it in Bowles versus Heckman, 64 Northeast 2nd, 660. And quoting Chaflin, or Claflin, C-L-A-F-L-I-N, and further stating, the several states of the Union are neither foreign to the United States, nor are they foreign to each other, unquote. Now, there are lots of theories which float around through the freedom movement and the tax protest groups. And that's people are very prone to accept any contention or position without question or investigation. But if they fail to check out the sources upon which they rely, then they run the risk of believing something which has no foundation and will not work in court. Number 20, he takes up the issue of citizenship. In Boyd versus Nebraska, cited at 143 U.S. 135, decided in 1892, the U.S. Supreme Court said this. Mr. Justice Story, in his commentaries on the Constitution, says that every citizen of a state is ipso facto a citizen of the United States. Section 1693, and this is the view expressed by Mr. Rowell in his work on the Constitution, Chapter 9, pages 85 and 86, and Mr. Justice Curtis in Dred Scott v. Sanford, cited at 19 Howard Reports, page 393, expressed the opinion that under the Constitution of the United States, every free person born on the soil of a state who is a citizen of that state by force of its constitution or laws is also a citizen of the United States. And Mr. Justice Swain, in the Slaughterhouse Cases, cited at 16 Wallace Reports, page 36, declared that a citizen of a state is ipso facto a citizen of the United States. Now, when I was a youngster going to school back in the 1950s, that's what we learned in public school, that if you're a citizen of a state, you're a citizen of the United States, and if you're a citizen of the United States, you're a citizen of the state. It's a system of dual citizenship. Now look up the word citizenship, and you'll find that there are duties and obligations of citizenship. Now, I'm going to just ad lib a little bit. If you take the notion that you're the citizen of a state, and this was what Bob Weinrub was teaching back here in the 1980s, if you're a citizen of Oregon, you're not subject to the laws of the United States. That was the gist of the story. Therefore, you're not subject to federal income tax. You'd be subject to Oregon tax, but you'd have to be a citizen of the United States, and the only people that could be citizens of the United States were the people that were under the, oh, say, Puerto Rico, or Wake, or Guam Island, or the Panama Canal Zone, or Alaska, and Hawaii, the territories before statehood. Now, if you'll take a look at the operation, those people didn't pay a federal income tax until Alaska became a state, which made us all wonder at the time, why would these people in Alaska want to vote for statehood? When they do, they've got to pay federal income taxes. I guess somebody went up there and said, my God, look at all of the benefits you're going to get from statehood in the Union. Besides that, everybody else has opted for statehood, so why don't you? And I guess, like the flock of sheep theory, we don't want to be left behind, so we're going to join the flock. If I'd have been in Alaska or Hawaii back in 1959 when the issue came up, I'd have voted against it. Why would I want to be a citizen of the United States subject to the income tax? People in Puerto Rico don't pay income tax. What do you want, statehood? You people down in Puerto Rico, what do you want statehood for? But, you know, that's the way people are. Ipso facto, citizen of the United States if you're citizen of a state. It's been decided, you know, clear back in the last century. Now, number 21, the law is not copyrighted. There's an argument floating around the freedom movement that the law is copyrighted. Now, that's total nonsense. The law is owned by the public and cannot be copyrighted. Now, back in 1834, two reporters for the U.S. Supreme Court got involved in a legal battle over the cases of the Supreme Court in Wheaton versus Peters. Cited at 8 Peters 591, 1834, the Supreme Court declared that no reporter can have any copyright in the written opinions delivered by this court. Decisions of the courts belong to the public, and no one can copyright those decisions. West Publishing Company, one of the largest publishers of legal materials, knows that it cannot copyright cases. So instead, West Publishing places in its electronic versions of the cases the following caveat. It says, copyright, West Group, 1998. No claim to original U.S. government words. 952 Fed Supplement 647, McCann versus Greenway. And they put in copyright West Group, 1998. No claim to original U.S. government works. 974 Federal Supplement 1411. But what about statutes? This is addressed in 17 U.S.C. Section 105. It says, quote, subject matter of copyright, United States government works. Well, copyright protection under this title is not available for any work of the United States government, but the United States government is not precluded from receiving and holding copyrights transferred to it by assignment, bequest, or otherwise. So those that are arguing that the law is copyrighted are totally wrong, but this argument is an important part of the argument for those who promote the grand theory that we are still subjects of the British Crown under the apparent contention that the king or the Queen, in this case Queen Elizabeth, still today owns the law of the United States? Well, as shown above, public documents belong to the public and they cannot be copyrighted. When any court decides any case, anyone may go obtain a copy of that decision. I can get any decision you or I or anybody else can, and West Publishing can. I may, and you may, and West Company does publish those cases. I could start my own company publishing these cases and making them available to whoever would buy them. However, I doubt that I would stay in business long against West. It has hundreds of people employed by their company who get these cases. Then they read the cases and make little head notes about various legal points in the cases. In these cases, it publishes these cases in nicely bound books, and it takes the head notes and then generates for these cases and puts them into a legal encyclopedia, which group all of these head notes together of all cases in specific categories using West studying and finding law has been made a lot easier. West Publishing also has a competitor called Lawyers Co-op. The federal government publishes acts of Congress in a set of books called Statutes at Large. In large university libraries, you can find the Statutes at Large. However, the feds also publish the United States Code, which is simply stated, the Statutes at Large organized in a more methodical fashion by way of titles. You can find the true blue, but it is really red in color, U.S. Code in many libraries. However, since the code is a public document, anyone can copy it. So here, West and Lawyers Co-op are fierce competitors, with one publishing USCA and the other publishing USCS. Both contain accurate reprints of the various uncopyrightable sections and the titles of the official U.S. Code. However, West employs hundreds of people who read and categorize these cases. West then puts summaries of many cases at the end of sections of the U.S. Code. So when you engage in legal research, cases regarding a specific statute are there at your fingertips. Lawyers Co-op does the same thing. All of this other writing in these versions of the code was created by these companies, and this is the material which is copyrighted in these books. So the case itself isn't copyrighted. The words in Miranda versus Arizona aren't copyrighted, but the work that the publishing company does to organize those cases, put in headnotes and footnotes and things like that, that is copyrighted. But the material itself, the story, isn't copyrighted, and anybody can use those. Now, I never use the official U.S. Code, and neither does anyone else. It just sits up there on the top shelf in our local law library gathering dust. The reason that nobody uses the official, now that's the official version, is because of the absence of these handy research materials, like case summaries and other references. So if I have a conspiracy case, I pull out USCS, turn to Title 18 USC 371, and I start reading the very refined annotations at the end of the section, which quickly point you to the relevant cases. So it wasn't always this way. Years ago, the states officially published their own legal materials. Cases and Codes and West was the competitor, and as time passed, West acquired dominant market share because its books were superior to everyone else's. Legislatures would appropriate funds for official case books, which were often large, expensive books with large print. West published smaller books with smaller print, and its publications were obviously cheaper. Now, why would anybody buy from the state its publications of the cases when for probably the same price or less, you could buy from West its regional reporter containing cases not only from your state, but from several adjoining states. So in short, free enterprise beat the socks off of the government. So today, many states just let West Publishing Company do all of the publishing of cases. Of course, anyone could compete against West Publishing. Now, West is not fearful of copyright infringement from the public at large. I violate the copyright laws every time I go to the law library, and so does everyone else. The law schools are perhaps the biggest violators, and law students copy away at copyrighted materials. West does not care. In fact, it wants everyone using West products. It fears, however, that another competitor like Lexis. Now, Lexis, back in the early 1980s, started putting cases on computer, but it used West's page numbers from its case volumes. So West sued, and West Publishing won against Lexis for infringement, the court holding that the only thing West could copyright were its own page numbers. That's its own page numbers from its books as well as from the headnotes that it wrote for those cases. So as a result, West and Lexis formed a partnership, and now cases are on compact disc. Formerly, to buy all of West's Supreme Court Reporter, it would have cost you several thousands of bucks. But now, two discs with all of the Supreme Court cases can be bought for a couple hundred dollars. Private enterprise has thus run circles around government. Government is not very efficient. All right, let's take a look at number 22, the straw man or site drafts. That's a big issue today. Many people have been drawn into these site drafts and straw men. Well, there's a new theory floating around in the movement, which is absolutely crazy. And yet it is promoted as the hot new solution. And this new theory has its origins with a fellow by the name of Roger Elvick. Elvick has been involved with some con jobs in the past. In Buy versus Mac, cited at 519 Northwest 2nd, 302 up in North Dakota, 1994. Roger Elvick was, years ago, into the idea of sending forms 1099 to the IRS for its agents and then claim that those agents stole your constitutional rights. Now, this was a part of his redemption process. Back then, you see, if you wished to learn about what happened to one party who followed Elvick's advice, just read United States versus Wiley. You'll see that cited at 979 Federal Fed Second, page 365 in the Fifth Circuit, decided in 1992. You see, many others who followed Elvick's advice also went to jail. You'll see that in United States versus Dykstra, 991 Fed Second on page 450, decided by the Eighth Circuit in 1994. So Elvick voluntarily made the decision to purchase and then use Elvick's redemption program. I should say Wiley voluntarily made the decision to purchase and then use Elvick's redemption program, and he admitted that he did not pay any of the purported recipients any of the amounts reflected on these 1099 forms. Because he knew he never paid these people, he could not have believed that the forms which he signed under penalties of perjury were in fact true, accurate, and correct. The evidence also established that the appellant acted corruptly in pursuing the retaliation scheme in violation of 26 U.S.C. section 7212A. Now, I know Roger went to jail, and my recollection is that his incarceration arose from this activity. Now, while there, Roger Elvick developed this new argument while he was in prison. In essence, he contends that everyone's birth certificate constitutes ownership in the United States of America Incorporated. Ownership in the USA Incorporated, and we all have stock in this corporation, which stock is represented by these birth certificates. Did you follow that? Let me read it to you again. Roger Elvick. Now, this is the straw man redemption site draft program. It's the hot thing in America today as I speak to you in 2004. So here's the guy that developed it. Now, this guy, Elvick, has been to prison, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times. I can't tell you, but it's more than once, more than twice. I'm pretty sure it's 3, could be 4 or 5. He's kind of like Erwin Schiff in a way. I met this guy, Elvick, one time. He was out on the road doing his lectures, and I listened to the program that he was espousing. And my conclusion was that he was some kind of a nut, a fruitcake. I don't know if he's mentally unbalanced or what the problem is, but that was my conclusion, just my own personal opinion. I told my wife, I said, you know, I think this guy's nuts. That doesn't make any sense to me. I can't make heads or tails out of it. So she arranged for us to have dinner one time. We're sitting in a restaurant, and here's Roger Elvick came in, and he's one of these identity kind of guys, and he's kind of religious. I think he's a preacher. I'm not quite positive about that, as I recall. He was working with another guy at the time, and I kind of thought that he was a religious guy, and I said, well, I'll just chalk this up to religion, because when I run across religious people, oftentimes their ideas are, frankly, just insane. They're not scriptural. They're not legal or lawful. They're not constitutional. They just don't make any sense. It's kind of anarchy. They're anarchist or anarchical. So let me cover this for you again. While in prison, Roger Elvick developed this new argument. So in essence, Elvick contends that everyone's birth certificate constitutes ownership in America. And we all have stock in this corporation. Which stock is represented by these birth certificates? Now see Lodi versus Lodi, that's spelled L-O-D-I versus L-O-D-I, cited at 173 California Appellate, 3rd edition, 628, where similar arguments have been rejected. Similar arguments have been rejected. Now in another case, cited Doe's versus United States, 86 U.S. Tax Court, 9773, Northern District of Iowa, 1986. The petitioner informs the court of his notorious rescission of his Social Security number and rescission of his birth certificate, which documents had previously made him a member of corporate America, converting him into a slave of the commune, subject to the regulation and control of the federal government. The fact that Dose has attempted to rescind his Social Security number and birth certificate by sworn affidavit is irrelevant. The big banks and other financial institutions regularly trade in these birth certificates, buying and selling them to others, and of course, according to this new argument, you can do the same thing. Well, let's pause here for a moment. Let's think about this for a second. I happen to know Gary Dosey, was a student here at school. And oftentimes, people will come to school and then they leave here. And they mix a little George Gordon along with a little Roger Elvick, and then they mix in a little Bob Wangrid, and maybe a little of Right Way Law, and a little of Jack Smith, and a little of Rick Schramm, and they kind of stir it all up together, and then they go off and they do something, and then they come up with these legal theories, etc., which ultimately end up having no merit. So let me share a little secret with you. Law doesn't work like school. You see, in school, you take a test, and you score 100 on the test. Well, you've aced the test, so you get 100, and they give you an A. But if you score 99 on the test, you'd also get an A. In fact, if you got 97, 96, 95, you'd still get an A. So to get an A, to pass the course, to get a good score, you don't have to ace the test. You just have to score pretty high. 96, 97, 98, 99, 100, that'll do it. Now, if you get 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, you still pass, but you get a B. Better yet, if you get 85, 86, 87, 88, 89, shucks, you get a C. If you get 82, 83, 84, you know, it could be 75, 76, 77, 78, you get a D. Not until you get below 70 do you get an F. Used to be, when I was a kid, if you could get 70% on a test, you could pass. You get a D minus. And then it went up from there. Now, if you got 69 on the test, you failed. You flunked. You got to do it over. All right, let's run this through, and let's take a look at what happens in the law. Let's suppose that the law has 6 or 8 points to it. Income taxes like that. I mean, checks, you can take a look at the income tax, Title 26, and heck, there's 15 or 20 books. They got thousands of statutes and rules and regulations. And if you want to succeed, you have to ace the test. If you want to avoid going to jail, you have to obey all of those laws all of the time, and there could be thousands of them. Take your state traffic code. You got 2,000 statutes in your traffic code. And when the policeman stops you, gives you a ticket, let's say, for speeding, and you say, but wait a minute, officer. Wait a minute. There's 2,000 laws here, and I've passed my test. Listen, I've got my driver's license. Look at this. I followed that law, and the car's registered, and I've got my proof of insurance right here. I was driving on the right side of the road, and I had my seatbelt buckled. I think the cop is going to say to you, well, son, we're not complaining about the seatbelt and registration, driver's license, and what side of the road you're driving on. We're complaining about your speed. And that's the only crime, that's the only breach that we're concerned about. It's the only one we want to fine you. It's the one we want to bring you back into compliance with. Here's the moral of the story. In law, we have to ace the test each and every time, all of the time. Otherwise, the wages of sin is death. If you break the law in one point, you've broken the law, period. If you break the law, there's a penalty. I didn't make it that way, I'm just telling you. Now, the difference between God and the state is that God says, I will forgive your sin. I will forgive your trespass upon repentance. The state says, we will never forgive your sin. We will keep that record on file forever, and we will use that against you forever. And then we're going to rack up points and raise your insurance premiums. And then in the future, if you get another speeding ticket, we're going to add more points, and we're going to punish you more. And then you'll be a 2-time loser, and then a 3-time loser. And then we're going to prosecute you not only for your crimes, but for being a repeat offender. I mean, there's no forgiveness of sin with the state, boys and girls. That's the way that game is played. All right, so you've got to perform the law perfectly, but in school, we only have to score in a passing zone. And then we go out into the real world, and then we get thumped by the law because, you know, we think we're doing pretty good. Buckled my seatbelt, and, you know, I'm practicing 96% of the traffic laws, and this damn cop comes along and complains. I should be getting an A. Instead, you get a fine. I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's the way the game is played, whether you like it or not. All right, now, of course, according to this new argument, you can do the same thing. And I would submit to you that Gary Dose did not learn this program here, but I'm sure that people will come here to school and they kind of pick and choose. They go to church and they kind of pick and choose which laws in the Bible they want to practice. And, of course, when you get caught violating one of these laws, there's a penalty to pay. Well, from here, the argument goes downhill and becomes even more bizarre. And I know precisely what are the major features of this argument because I've read the course material. And I even viewed a videotape of one meeting where this issue was discussed. Now, this contention is totally crazy. However, many people are studying this new issue, and they're even issuing site drafts based on this argument. But the promoters of this argument, like Roger Elvick and Wally Peterson and Ron Nutt and Dave DeRemer, are really selling federal indictments. Now, you're free to buy into the scheme if you want to, but be ready to face criminal charges. And the maximum term of imprisonment is 25 years. And he goes on to say that here's some late breaking news. It's an email regarding the law enforcement activity against the redemption advocates. Let's take a look at redemption and what's going on in that area. So if you've been taken into this scheme and you're practicing redemption and you've got your straw man out there and you're writing papers to the IRS and so on, you're letting everybody know what you're doing. January 11th, 2000, now this is 4 years ago, I was just informed that a federal SWAT team, approximately 30, raided a farmhouse near the town of Evert, E-V-A-R-T, Michigan, this AM. The raid started at approximately 6 a.m. and lasted 4 hours until 10 a.m. They captured the occupants, made them sit and watch the proceedings. They were told nothing except that they were not under arrest. The raid was pursuant to a grand jury subpoena and it contained a warrant for any and all items relating to accepted for value, site drafts, and anything to do with IRS and United States securities. I was told that there were 22 people on the list that were raided this AM, and at least one of the occupants there was served a grand jury subpoena to appear and testify in February. No further information at this time, so be advised. So what is going to happen? Well, I bet that those who advocated using acceptance for value to refuse criminal process, like an indictment or information, will be charged with obstruction of justice, and they'll be tied into a giant conspiracy of those who told others to send in site drafts drawn on the U.S. Treasury. Now, this kind of stupidity will just be another instance where the freedom movement will be held up to the press and the rest of America as a bunch of lunatic fringe nuts and fruitcakes and dangerous ones at that. Now, there are certain very fundamental flaws within this argument, which are as follows. Well, let me pause here for a moment. Let me bring you up to speed. Let me tell you a little story here about what I observed. I don't know, this is about 2, maybe 3 years ago. Some people up in Ohio, I think around Cleveland, Ohio, wanted to come down and take some schools here, and they showed up, and there's 5 or 6 guys, and they come in and they go to school. And pretty soon they start talking about site drafts and, you know, without prejudice and UCC, and they're talking about accepted for value and straw men. And now, you know, I'm just an old country boy, and I didn't know much about this. This was my initiation into this UCC, accepted for value, straw man program. And over the years, I've had many people come through here with many versions of this. Many versions. They're not all the same. Different people, different groups, different organizations. They've bought into the principal concept, and then they've changed it so that they can sell it to their members or show that it was their original idea, or. Well, this one guy was a real estate broker, and he was up in Philadelphia. He told me he was the first black real estate broker licensed by the state of Pennsylvania back about 1960 or so. Pretty prestigious guy. This guy is handling some pretty good-sized deals, sales of buildings and mortgages of $1 million or more. We're not talking small potatoes. And this guy is out here issuing these drafts and papers using numbers and some kind of a scheme that I don't understand to this day. And he said, but these checks are clearing. These site drafts are clearing. They're being paid. And he was paying off mortgages of $200,000, $300,000 on buildings and just having a good time. Another guy in the group had paid off the mortgage of his house. It was $200,000 up in Michigan. Went out and bought a new Ford Explorer. He was very proud of the fact that he had this new Ford Explorer. So when I heard this, I said, well, boys, it sounds like paper hanging to me. It sounds like bad checks. And so one of them gave me the paperwork that he had, and boy, these checks look good. I mean, they look pretty impressive to me. I'm not an expert in writing bad checks, but these checks sure look good to me. Well, I sent one off to my broker out in Boise, and I said, well, what do you think of this, Frank? And he said, well, this is paper hanging. These guys are writing bad checks. And here's the way the thing worked. Somebody somewhere gave a code number with the Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C. Now, the Department of Transportation is a big government bureaucracy. They handle billions of dollars a year. So let's suppose that the Transportation Department out in San Francisco, California, wants to buy a new Ford Explorer. You got to have this code number. And this code number changes, and it has to be current. And then you write up a piece of paper. Well, when you present this piece of paper to the Ford dealer, and you say, here's a site draft drawn on the Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C., San Francisco office, they simply call the bank and say, is this good? The bank goes down their list of code numbers and says, of course it's good. And they accept it. And the guy drives out in the Ford Bronco. Now, talk about identity theft. You know, identity theft is small potatoes compared to some of these games. So identity theft is some guy stealing your identity and using your credit card to steal a few $1,000. These guys are stealing millions. Ah, but wait a minute. You see, the government doesn't audit these checks every day, but the Office of Management and Budget, you know, once every year or two, they go through and they check all these out. Well, a year later or so, one of these guys up in Cleveland calls me and he says, oh my God, the FBI was just here. And I said, well, of course the FBI was just there. It's just a matter of time. You know, you're writing a bad check on the United States government, for crying out loud. Doesn't your common sense tell you at some point in time, the FBI is going to come knocking on your door asking, where in the hell did you get that code? Where did you get that number? That was their number one question. They wanted to know, where did you get that number? Somebody inside the Department of Transportation gave it out. I'm sure that was a secret number they weren't supposed to give out. Now, if you or somebody somewhere finds the secret code number of Microsoft or General Motors or the Department of Transportation, you can write some pretty impressive checks. They'll take them. Well, then, of course, all of these guys are starting to come up for grand jury investigations, and all of a sudden we had a blank wall and I never heard from these guys again. I presume they've been arrested and jailed and prosecuted and convicted. So let me just add my little piece of warning here along with Larry Beecraft and tell you that this whole scheme of straw men and UCC, I did a series on this and I put it on compact disc. If you want the series, call the law school and we'll tell you how to get that. I exposed it and went into the detail and got the names, numbers, dates, times and places and facts, witnesses and evidence, and I can explain to you in detail what it is that I saw occur, because I've got the documentation and I did that. But I can't keep up with every scheme that goes on in the world. There are schemes out there that I've never heard of and or haven't heard of yet and may never hear of, or some variation of some student who comes in here and uses this, like this fellow Dose. You can go to law school here. That doesn't mean that you learned your criminal behavior here any more than Richard Nixon learned his criminal behavior from the law school that he attended. Hey, we're just about out of time. We got to take it up here again next time. We'll be back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, of course. Keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at area code 417-273-4967. We'll take it up right here. We'll talk about these birth certificates. This is where we'll start next time on straw men and UCC. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by titling date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And all of these Law Hour programs are free of charge, of course, on the Internet. Hey, I gotta go. See you next time, right here, on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So until then, good night, friends.